Where Love Is by William John Locke. Chapter 1. The First Glimpse.
"Have you dined at Ranelagh lately?" asked Norma Hardacre.
"I've never been there in my life," replied Jimmy Padgate.
"In fact," he added simply, "I'm not quite sure whether I know where it is."
"Yours is the happier state. It is one of the dullest spots in a dull world."
"Then why on earth do people go there?"
The inquiry was so genuine that Miss Hardacre relaxed her expression of handsome boredom and laughed.
"Because we are all like the muttons of Panurge," she said. "Where one goes, all go. Why are we here tonight?"
"Well, to enjoy ourselves. How could one do otherwise in Mrs. Deering's house?"
"You've known her a long time, I believe," remarked Norma, taking the opportunity of directing the conversation to a non-contentious topic.
"Ah, since she was in short frocks. She's a cousin of King's. That's the man who took you down to dinner."
She nodded.
"I've known Mr. King many weary ages."
"And he's never told me about you?"
"Why should he?"
She looked him full in the face, with the stony calm of the fashionable young woman accustomed to take excellent care of herself. Her companion met her stare in whimsical confusion. Even so ingenuous a being as Jimmy Padgate could not tell a girl he had met for the first time that she was beautiful, adorable, and graced with divine qualities above all women, and that intimate acquaintance with her must be the startling glory of a lifetime.
"If I had known you for ages," he replied prudently, "I should have mentioned your name to Morland King."
"Are you such friends, then?"
"Fast friends. We were at school together, and as I was a lonely little beggar, I used to spend many of my holidays with his people. That is how I knew Mrs. Deering in short frocks."
"It's odd, then, that I haven't met you about before," said the girl, giving him a more scrutinizing glance than she had hitherto troubled to bestow upon him. A second afterwards she felt that her remark might have been in the nature of an indiscretion, for her companion had not at all the air of a man moving in the smart world to which she belonged. His dress suit was old and of lamentable cut. His shirt cuffs were frayed. A little bone stud, threatening every moment to slip the buttonhole, precariously secured his shirt front. His thin, iron-grey hair was untidy. His moustache was ragged, innocent of wax or tongs or any of the adventitious aids to masculine adornment. His aspect gave the impression, if not of poverty, at least of narrow means and humble ways of life. Although he had sat next to her at dinner, she paid little attention to him, finding easier entertainment in her conversation with King on topics of common interest than in possible argument with a strange man whom she heard discussing the functions of art and other such head-spitting matters with his right-hand neighbour. Her question about Ranelagh, when she found him by her side later in the drawing-room, was practically the first she had addressed to him with any show of interest. She hastened to repair her maladroit observation by adding, before he could reply, "That is rather an imbecile thing to say, considering the millions of people in London. But one is apt to talk in an imbecile manner after a 12 hours' day of hard racket in the season. Don't you think so? One's stock of ideas gets used up, like the air at the end of a dance."
"Not if you keep your soul properly ventilated," he answered.
The words were, perhaps, not so arresting as the manner in which they were uttered. Norman Hardacre was startled. A little shutter in the back of her mind seemed to have flashed open for an elusive second, and revealed a prospect wide, generous, alive with three blowing airs. Then all was dark again before she could realise the vision. She was disconcerted, and in a much more feminine way than was habitual with her, she glanced at him again. This time she lost sight of the poor, untidy garments, and found a sudden interest in the man's kind, careworn face, and his eyes, wonderfully blue and bright, set far apart in the head, that seemed to look out on the world with a man's courage and a child's confidence. She was uncomfortably conscious of being in contact with a personality widely different from that of her usual masculine associates. This, her training and habit of mind, caused her to resent. Despising the faint spiritual shock, she took refuge in flippancy.
"I fear our Chobin tubes get choked up in London," she said with a little laugh. "Even if they didn't, they are wretched things which create draughts. So anyway, our souls are free from chills. Look at that woman over there talking to Captain Orton. Everyone knows he's Paymaster General. A breath of fresh air in Mrs. Chance's soul would give it rheumatic fever."